Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, we have a very important show from start to finish. We open with the latest updates on hundreds of Christians captured by ISIS militants in Syria, including reactions from leaders in our local Iraqi Christian community right here in East County. From Washington, we'll have the latest actions of Congress to keep Homeland Security from shutting down, at least for now, and details on President Obama's veto of the Keystone XL pipeline. Then on Green Scene, hear why the EPA is being sued to protect monarch butterflies. We also have a success story today on East County Magazine's efforts to bring some sunshine to a local fire board that has agreed to open up its finance meetings in response to our request to allow media coverage, since the San Miguel Fire Board has been in the hot seat lately over financial discrepancies that triggered a state investigation. Today we also have a special report on new allegations of corruption at the California Public Utilities Commission, this time involving smart meters. It turns out that the PUC chairman, Michael Peavy, admitted smart meters are harming the health of some Californians years ago, and he complained about his own utility bills going sky high after a smart meter was installed at his own home, documents provided to us reveal. On our health report, we'll tell you about a new record set in San Diego County for whooping cough cases and what you should know about the disease. We also have news about a tragedy involving a 7-year-old boy in El Cajon and some safety tips for pedestrians that can stop the high number of pedestrian fatalities in our region. On the second half of our show, our newsmaker interview today is with David Griffith Eisenstein, a local lawyer who has a case on appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, seeking to hold Target responsible for the death of a shopper who died of sudden cardiac arrest. You may be shocked to find out how much having an automatic external defibrillator can improve your odds of surviving a heart attack, and what some people are doing to try and make big box retailers have these life-saving devices in their stores. Then from Public News Service, learn about efforts to halt the sale of dog and cat meat in California. Today on Bookshelf, we'll replay our interview with author Kirkley Ader about his book, Child of the Storm, recalling the life and successes of a well-known local surfer, Chris O'Rourke. We'll also have news about some ancient treasures found illicitly smuggled into San Diego, treasures that have since been returned to their rightful owner. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. The abduction of at least 262 Assyrian Christians by the Islamic State, or ISIS, militants is causing grave concerns here in San Diego's East County, home to tens of thousands of Chaldean and Assyrian Christian immigrants from the Middle East. The hostages include at least 262 men, women, and children taken from villages in northeastern Syria last week, CNN reports. Open Doors USA, an organization serving persecuted Christians worldwide, reports that the captives include 72 families. The captives are reportedly being tried by an ISIS court for purported ties to militants fighting ISIS extremists. Some are accused of joining with Kurdish Peshmerga fighters to combat ISIS, according to International Business Times. One bright spot amid this sobering news is that Associated Press reports 19 of the Christian captives have been freed. AP and others cite multiple activist sources for that news. The Middle East publication Haaretz confirms some captives have been released, though estimates on the exact number varies. Those found guilty of fighting against ISIS, also known as ISIL, however, are likely to be executed, and concerns have also been raised that some captives could be forced into slavery, as ISIS has done already with other young women and girls that its militants have captured. Reactions around the world have been swift. The U.S. launched additional airstrikes on ISIS after the hostages were seized, the Global Post reports. And at the Vatican, Pope Francis led a prayer for the abducted Christians. U.S. News reports the Pope promised that the victims would not be forgotten, calling them these sisters and brothers who suffer for their faith in Syria and Iraq. Here in San Diego's East County, home to so many who fled war and persecution in the Middle East, opinions are divided as to what approach should be taken to save Christians in Iraq and Syria. Chaldean American spokesman Mark Arabo announced a trip to Washington, D.C. early next week to meet with White House officials and discuss the crisis. Arabo says his sources indicate as many as 300 people may have been taken hostage. In a press statement released Friday, Arabo said, "I fly to Washington, D.C. this coming week with the weight of hundreds of abducted Christians on my heart. The longer our country continues to be unresponsive to the threat of ISIS, the greater their reach becomes. The indifference shown by the White House and members of Capitol Hill is a death sentence to my people," he added. In an earlier statement on February 24th, Arabo said he held a phone call with White House Director for Iraq, Andrew Kim, calling for swift and effective protection for religious minorities throughout the Middle East. Arabo says his White House meeting next week will focus on a two-stage priority laid out by Obama administration officials, including improving security with locally based governments and militias fighting ISIS, as well as facilitating reentry of the State Department into northern Iraq to process some 30,000 visa slots for persecuted Christian refugees seeking safe haven in America. But he believes more must be done to protect religious minorities from ISIS. "The genocide of Christians persists in the region," Arabo concludes, "and without action from the White House, we face the extinction of a people throughout the Middle East." We are hoping to get Mr. Arabo onto our show next week after he returns from Washington for an exclusive interview on how that all works out. Meanwhile, Ben Colasio, president of the San Diego East County Chaldean Chamber of Commerce, has a very different perspective. "I think that Obama has proven to be an astute military strategist," Colasio told East County Magazine Sunday. Colasio said he supports the airstrikes and drone attacks on ISIS, but would oppose sending in U.S. ground troops. Instead, he hopes to see more Arab nations, such as Jordan, join in combating ISIS, as well as more shared intelligence, including intelligence from Israel. In an editorial that he published in East County Magazine, Colasio calls for unity among bickering Christian factions to form a unified front against the crisis posed by the ISIS forces, a crisis that echoes genocide from a century ago, when hundreds of thousands of Christians in the region were slaughtered. He quotes Churchill, warning that those who fail to learn from history may be doomed to repeat it. "Assyrian, Chaldean, and Syriac communities must use this moment in history to break down barriers put up by our own religious factions," Colasio states in his editorial, which was published as an open letter to Chaldeans, Syriacs, and Assyrians worldwide. "Seize the moment," he concludes, adding, "the world is watching." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Leon Thompson with the Capitol Report. A shutdown of Homeland Security due to take effect Sunday has been postponed, but only short term. On Friday, the House and Senate passed a one-week funding bill, which the president signed shortly before midnight. Republicans in control of Congress still refuse to pass a longer-term funding measure unless it includes language to repeal immigration reforms that President Barack Obama issued by executive order. The last-minute action forced the Obama administration to start preparations for a shutdown, which was narrowly averted, but could still occur if a long-term funding measure is not approved this week. Even a bill to fund Homeland Security failed to win passage, with extremists willing to shut down Homeland Security if they could halt deferred deportations for undocumented family members of legal immigrants and citizens. Democrats have asked for separate votes on a clean Homeland Security funding bill to protect national security and separate votes on immigration issues. But Speaker John Boehner, a Republican, has refused to bring a clean bill up for a vote. The one-week emergency funding measure was passed with cooperation of House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, and Speaker Boehner. Not all Republicans oppose a long-term funding measure. Republican Charlie Dent of Pennsylvania, who serves on the Appropriations Subcommittee focused on Homeland Security, has this to say: "I think a lot of people around here have to get serious about governing," Dent told reporters Friday night. The Hill reports, "This is about protecting the country right now. We're living in a time of enhanced, increased terror activity around North America and around the world. We need to get on with the business of funding Homeland Security.
President Barack Obama last week vetoed the Keystone XL pipeline bill passed by the Republican-controlled Congress. In his veto message, the president criticized the congressional attempt to bypass his administration's environmental review of the project and circumvent what he called long-standing and proven processes for determining whether or not building and operating a cross-border pipeline serves the national interest. Republicans in Congress could seek to override the veto, an action that would require two-thirds of both houses and is considered unlikely to succeed. Supporters of the project have cited job creation as their primary reason, along with meeting energy demands. Opponents have argued the project would be environmentally destructive, contributing to greenhouse gas emissions, and have argued for greater use of clean alternatives instead. Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Bruhn issued a statement praising the veto, adding, "That's what he said he'd do from the start, but Republicans in Congress continued to waste everyone's time with a bill destined to go nowhere just to satisfy the agenda of their big oil allies." But Senate Energy and Natural Resource Chairman Lisa Murkowski, a Republican from Alaska, said, "I'm disappointed because I think the president is missing an opportunity when it comes to jobs and North American energy independence." The pipeline would bring tar sands from Canada to the Gulf Coast ports, crossing Midwestern states in the U.S. Despite the veto and the unlikely prospects of an override, however, the project is not dead, since the Obama administration could potentially still approve or reject the Keystone XL pipeline for good after the environmental review process is completed.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Leon Thompson with the Green Scene Report. The National Resources Defense Council has filed a lawsuit against the United States Environmental Protection Agency claiming the federal agency ignored dangers to monarch butterflies posed by glyphosate used in Monsanto's Roundup and other herbicides. The suit claims the EPA has refused to review a large body of scientific evidence that environmental organizations submitted showing devastating impacts on monarchs from glyphosate. Further, the suit suggests that glyphosate applied to farm yields have destroyed milkweed that migrating monarchs must have to survive. The suit blames glyphosate for the demise in populations of monarch butterflies, which dropped from 1 billion in 1997 to just 56.5 million butterflies this year. Monarch migrations from Canada to Mexico provide dramatic annual spectacles here in California. Roundup is popular with farmers due to Roundup-ready crops genetically engineered to tolerate use of the herbicide. Efforts to save monarchs have included a $3.2 million campaign announced by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, while environmental groups and other organizations have also launched efforts urging the public to plant milkweed. Use of exotic milkweed strains, however, can actually cause harm to the butterflies and discourage them from migrating. So native species of milkweed are recommended for planting in our region.
As a result of an East County Magazine inquiry, the San Miguel Fire District's board has voted to make its finance committee a permanent standing committee. That means that the committee's meetings will now be open to the press and the public. Previously, the finance committee was deemed an ad hoc committee by the district, which argued that it did not need to allow public access or even provide minutes of what transpired or agendas. East County Magazine contacted Californians Aware, or CalAware, an organization that protects public access under California's sunshine laws. CalAware General Counsel Terry Frank advised us that the Finance Committee could be construed as a standing committee subject to the Ralph M. Brown Open Government Act after he reviewed district records on the committee's creation. While the board disputed that it should be required to open records of prior meetings, after an East County Magazine request to open future meetings to the public, the board voted to make the committee a permanent standing committee and do just that. Now, here's what fired us up to believe the public should have a right to know what's happening in the San Miguel Fire Board's financial committee meetings. As we reported earlier, a state investigation of the district's finances found major discrepancies. The state controller's report indicated that California launched its investigation because the district understated revenues in fiscal year 2010-2011 by over a half million dollars and by more than $2 million in the next fiscal year.
In addition, the state contended that expenditures were overstated by $827,000 and $987,000 during those 2 years, plus grant revenues were overstated by more than $1.8 million in fiscal year 2011-2012 alone. San Miguel later formed a partnership with CAL FIRE to handle its firefighting services for the district. We asked CAL FIRE Public Information Officer Kendall Bortissier for an explanation regarding the differences in the reporting of revenues. He says the numbers used in the State Comptroller's Office report were unaudited numbers that did not reflect findings of the independent audit completed about 6 months later. He said, "The actual independent audit is the official reporting of the district's financial position." But the district still has not provided details as to exactly why it was off by hundreds of thousands of dollars, or in one case, over $2 million in its initial report. Now, the state found no evidence of actual wrongdoing, but because there were grounds for an investigation, and because the district missed a deadline to provide follow-up information, the district's hefty bookkeeping discrepancies will cost taxpayers, who must now foot the bill for the full expenses of the state's investigation. East County Magazine has asked the district to disclose what the cost of that state investigation to taxpayers will be, and we will publish that information once we receive it. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
An analysis conducted by consumer watchdog groups of 120,000 emails and attachments released by the California Public Utilities Commission have found shocking revelations, according to documents provided to East County Magazine. These include evidence that commissioners knew smart meters were harming the health of some Californians, yet conspired with utility companies to cover up health hazards, mock those with health concerns, and intentionally set opt-out fees high to force smart meters on the poor. The emails were between the PUC and two utility companies, Pacific Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison. Josh Hart, in a press release issued by Stop Smart Meters, states that these emails reveal the extent of corruption and backroom dealing that have characterized the state's smart meter program. Those emails reveal that former PUC President Michael Peavy was aware of health problems caused by smart meters early on in the program, and that commissioners and staff themselves experienced overcharging and electronic interference issues with smart meters. Peavy, who retired in December and is currently the subject of a criminal probe by the U.S. Attorney and the State Attorney General, who are investigating allegations of bribery and corruption, assured the public that these meters were accurate and that electromagnetic frequencies, or EMFs, posed no threat to human health. But, Peavy wrote to PG&E way back in September 2010, there really are people who feel pain, etc., related to EMF. He then proposed that consumers with doctor's notes confirming health problems related to smart meters be quietly allowed to opt out, rather than have them become, quote, hysterical. In another email from 2010, Peavy's chief of staff, Carol Brown, writes to PG&E, "So far, I have done okay just listening to the sad tales of EMF poisoning and telling them thank you for bringing it to our attention, and then not offering them any solution. I just wanted to have a resource in case." Brian Cherry, vice president of regulatory relations at PG&E, offered this flippant reply, "Prozac might be a solution." Hart responds, "Suggesting that people take pharmaceuticals to treat health problems caused by the company's smart meters is unspeakably arrogant, dangerous, and corrupt. The only thing that has consistently helped people suffering health effects from EMF has been the removal of smart meters and other nearby wireless transmitters. And the utilities knew it. But to officially have smart meters removed," he says, "the PUC under Peavy required Californians to pay an upfront fee and monthly charge starting in January 2012. Now, in public, the utilities and the PUC justified the $75 upfront charge and the $10 monthly fees for switching back to analog meters by arguing that individuals should pay for the costs they create. In private, however, a different story emerges. In emails between California Utilities and Marja Zafar, the PUC's current director of policy and planning, the 15-year utility employee, who also spent 4 years as a Southern California gas lobbyist, tells the utilities, "I think if there is not an initial fee, your estimate of 2% opt-out goes out the door, and you'll have more like 20% or 50% opt-out, which will then make the whole project that we spent over $7 billion on a complete and total waste. Thus, Zafar at the PUC suggested the opt-out fee was needed not to cover costs, but to assure that fees would remain unaffordable, suppress consumer choice, and force poor Californians to keep smart meters even if they were dangerous for their health. Making it more difficult for those in poverty to opt out seemed to be a particular priority for Southern California Edison, PV's former employer. Many low-income customers live in apartment buildings where banks of smart meters expose residents to even higher levels of pulsed RF radiation that the World Health Organization considers a Class 2B carcinogen. CARE is a reduced utility rate program for families living below the federal poverty line. In January 2012, Michael Hoover at Southern California Edison wrote to Zafar at the PUC and to Cherry at PG&E. He said, "We need an upfront fee that is significant, or a path to achieve that. This is especially true for CARE customers. This is a big deal for us, and I think the potential for significant increases in opt-out is rather large if the fee is set too low. Are we all on the same page?" Now it turns out that Marzia Zafar knew from personal experience that there were serious problems with the meters. Back in January 2011, she wrote to PG&E, "I'm also copying Cliff to this email as I spoke with him this morning. He came to my house. I have a smart meter and a motion light interference that is hopefully now resolved." According to the LA Times, when a smart meter was installed on President Michael Peavy's 3,118-square-foot home in Sea Ranch on the Sonoma County coast, Peavy's bills went through the roof, and he complained to PG&E in November 2011 when he wrote, "Please check something out for me. Just had a smart meter installed at Sea Ranch, and now I have the bill for the first month. Something is screwy. The bill says we used 973 kilowatt hours versus 438 for the same time period 1 year ago. Yet there was no one at the house during the most recent 30-day period, nor was anyone there 1 year ago. Obviously, something is wrong. I would like an explanation." Apparently, PV wasn't the only commissioner who reported significant overcharging. PG&E wrote in an email that two commissioners in one night complained about inaccuracies on their bills after smart meters were installed. While PUC officials privately grappled with problems caused by smart meters at their own homes, publicly they denied these problems existed. Now that's despite thousands of complaints to the contrary from consumers who confirmed there were systemic problems. The opt-out policy, which critics contend is unfair, extortionate, and in violation of the California Public Utility Code, was approved anyhow, charging customers hundreds of dollars a year if they sought to protect their health and safety by asking to have a smart meter removed. The consumer groups that analyzed those 120,000 emails include the EMF Safety Network, Ecological Options Network, and locally the Center for Electrosmog Prevention in La Mesa. Hart, director of the Stop Smart Meters Group, concludes, "Those responsible for this criminal activity should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, and the California legislature needs to do its job and hold hearings to get to the bottom of these criminal relationships that have cost Californians their lives." He adds, "All redacted emails must immediately be made public. PV and company should be put behind bars." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson with the Health Report. Whooping cough cases are on the rise in San Diego, and that's got health officials concerned. Last year, 2,072 cases of whooping cough, or pertussis, were confirmed in San Diego County. That's a new record, the county's Health and Human Services Agency reports. Statewide, over 11,000 cases were reported last year, and San Diego's rate of whooping cough is double the state rate. Six deaths have occurred in California in the past 2 years from whooping cough, which can cause serious complications, including pneumonia and bleeding behind the eyes into the brain. Wilma Wooten, County Public Health Officer, says whooping cough activity in our region has been high since 2013, adding, "The epidemic appears to be continuing into 2015. So far this year, 157 cases have been confirmed in our county. Newborns are very susceptible to whooping cough because they are too young to be fully vaccinated. It is vital for pregnant women to be vaccinated in the third trimester to give protection to their unborn infants. 40 local cases required hospitalization in 2014, and 26 of those were babies less than 1 year old. A typical case of pertussis starts with a cough and runny nose for 1 to 2 weeks. followed by weeks to months of rapid coughing fits that sometimes end with a whooping sound. Fever, if present, is usually mild. Antibiotics can lessen the severity of symptoms and prevent the spread of the disease to others. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends the following vaccination schedule. Young children need 5 doses of the vaccine by kindergarten at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 15 to 8 months, and 4 to 6 years. All students entering 7th grade need proof of whooping cough booster immunization. A booster is recommended for pregnant women during their 3rd trimester of each pregnancy, even if they get a booster shot before becoming pregnant. 1 dose is recommended for adults 19 years of age and older who did not get Tdap as an adolescent. You can get the vaccine series and booster shot for yourself and your children through your primary care physician. Local pharmacies offer vaccinations for a fee, and anyone who is not covered by a medical insurance plan can get the shot from a county public health center at minimum or no cost. For more information about whooping cough and ongoing vaccination clinics, visit sdiz.org.
This is Miriam Raftery reporting for East County Magazine with news of a tragic accident in El Cajon. A 7-year-old boy was struck by a car while crossing Peach Avenue in El Cajon on Thursday afternoon, and he later died from his injuries. Angel Cruz was a student at Naranja Elementary School. He was crossing the street to meet his mother and siblings, who were waiting for him in their vehicle. The driver, 18-year-old Mark Isaac, lived in the same neighborhood and was on his way to work when his silver Hyundai struck the child. Lieutenant Randy Soulard says the driver immediately stopped and has been cooperative in the investigation. He has not been cited, and neither speed nor alcohol are believed to be factors in this collision. El Cajon Police and Fire Department paramedics responded to the accident and transported the boy to Children's Hospital, where he later succumbed to his injuries. El Cajon has had 17 fatality pedestrian accidents from 2011 to 2014, as well as 61 serious injury accidents involving pedestrians during the same time period. Pedestrian accidents are also serious problems region-wide. In 2012, the city of San Diego ranked 8th in the nation for the most pedestrian fatalities with 22 deaths. Here are some tips for pedestrians to stay safe. Cross the street only at marked intersections. It's against the law to jaywalk, and more importantly, motorists aren't expecting to see pedestrians in the middle of the block. Use crosswalks where available and always wait for the walk symbol before crossing the street. Always look both ways before crossing, even if you have a green light or a walk symbol, in case a vehicle runs the light. Accompany young children crossing the street, since a driver may not be able to see a small child. When walking at night, wear light-colored clothing so motorists can see you. And in urban areas, always walk on sidewalks, never in the street or bicycle lane.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we're going to be talking about sudden cardiac arrest, and my very special guest today is David Griffith Eisenstein, who is an attorney handling a landmark case that is currently on appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Miriam. It's great to be here.
Now, your case centers around a woman, a shopper, who died of heart failure in a Target store. Tell us what the case is all about and what you wanted Target to do that they have refused to do.
Marianne Verdugo dropped over backwards dead. She keeled over backwards and died of a sudden cardiac arrest in the Pico Rivera superstore of Target in 2008. And she was shopping with her mother and her brother, her adult brother. Marianne herself, 49 years old, was developmentally disabled. But the three of them lived together happily before this event in their home in Maywood, California. And they were helpless. The mother and the brother were helpless to save Marianne because she was basically dead, except that her heart was experiencing rhythms that were not productive in increasing blood flow or distributing blood flow to the rest of her body. So she was basically clinically dead. She needed to have not only CPR administered to her to save her life, but an AED.
Which stands for Automated External Defibrillator, which many stores and many public buildings, courthouses and so forth already have.
Required by federal law to be in every federal building, including all the courthouses. Required by state law to be in all the state buildings, including all the courthouses.
But there's no law requiring big box retail stores to have them. And what was Target's policy? They didn't have one.
Well, they did have they didn't have an AED, but they had a policy against having an AED, even though they sold AEDs online for $1,000 and promoted the heck out of them.
Interesting. So they clearly don't have an issue with the safety of AEDs, or if they did, they shouldn't be selling them, right?
Well, no. They were definitely promoting the very important attributes of the AEDs and saving lives of people. If you put them on a person and follow the instructions very simply, which sixth graders are learning how to do in certain locations around the country, you will be very likely able to save that person from actually not coming back to life by administering the AED within 4 minutes.
Yeah, let's talk about that. If you get to somebody with an AED within 4 to 5 minutes, what is the rate of survival for that person versus the rate of survival with CPR alone and no AED?
Well, the rate of survival with CPR alone and no AED is about 10%.
And many of those people, even if they survive, may have brain damage or other problems.
Unfortunately, that's true. And then with the help of an AED, the necessary help of an AED, 60% approximately can be saved, up to 70. It depends a lot on how quickly the AED can be administered.
60 to 70%. So that's a huge increase. So how long did it take for emergency workers and ambulance to arrive in this case?
16 minutes.
16 minutes. So you have no chance, basically.
And the emergency techs, no, they don't have a chance to get there in 4 to 5 minutes. In a big box store like that, cavernous as it is, in Los Angeles especially, or any congested area, or even in rural areas, you know, the chances of getting emergency tech over to the person that is downed with a sudden cardiac arrest within 4 minutes are just nil.
Why does Target
Next
have a policy against this? Why are they so opposed to having this life-saving equipment in their stores? Is it cost or what?
Well, it really is befuddling to me, because if they did have an AED, we wouldn't have been able to bring a lawsuit on behalf of Marianne's mother and brother for wrongful death, because of our allegation was that the Target had been negligent in not having one on the premises. We wouldn't have been able to bring that suit, because Target would have been protected by the Good Samaritan aspects of state law, which if you do have an AED on your premises, you aren't going to be able to get sued successfully for negligence, so long as you have somebody who knows how to administer an AED. And again, I say it's so easy.
So an employee or somebody who's trained.
Yeah, somebody who's trained. And you have to have that employee available, and at least one AED, which cost about $1,000. So it's really befuddling. But I think that what they would say, and what the United States Chamber of Commerce has said in backing Target with respect to our lawsuit, as well as the California Chamber of Commerce has said in that regard, is that it's a slippery slope. So that if Target would agree to have a policy of having AEDs in their store, like the airports do, like the federal and state courts, like all the other public buildings and the federal and state systems, and as San Diego, the city, requires now of big box stores, if Target had had an AED, you know, if it was allowed to be held liable for not having an AED, then the slippery slope would be that there would be more attorneys out there who would be willing to file AEDCs.
Yeah, but as you pointed out, California at least has a Good Samaritan law that protects anybody who uses an AED who's trained from being sued, so Target couldn't be sued. Are there other retailers that care more about public safety, perhaps, who have put AEDs into their stores? Maybe for consumers out there, if they want a choice of where to shop, maybe, where can they go?
I'm told that Costco's got them, and we know that Walmart, unfortunately, doesn't have them.
Except maybe in the city of San Diego, which you mentioned. The city of San Diego now is requiring these in all large retailers.
Yep, that's right, and that's a great thing. And really, any town in San Diego County or elsewhere in the state could actually require these to be put in by the big box stores by ordinance.
Interesting point.
That's what anybody that's a resident of any municipality can go to their city council and advocate this.
So if a listener out there wants to go to their city council in El Cajon or La Mesa, I don't know if these cities already have this rule or not, but if not, if someone wants to go to their local town council or county supervisors and ask them to enact a law that would require these AEDs or automatic external defibrillators in major retail outlets or other places, where can they go to get information about the statistics and the safety and so forth?
I certainly would start with the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Foundation's website, SCAF. That's SCAF.org.
And they have filed an amicus brief in your favor, I understand, before the U.S. Supreme Court.
They did.
Now, you're also the founder of Monsta PAC, spelled M-O-N-S-T-A-H, PAC, P-A-C.
That is one of the issues that Monsta PAC is advocating for. They have others, but one of them is, I understand, supporting legislators who, at the federal level, who will support laws to require these AEDs in all these different places that the public goes to.
And really, we're not really advocating that these AEDs have to be placed in your local dry cleaner shop. I mean, you know, it would be nice if they had one, but we especially think that these big box stores have to have them.
Yeah, there you go. Now, as far as your lawsuit, you filed it. The trial court ruled against you, correct?
Based upon the trial courts, the district court, the United States District Court in Los Angeles, the trial court there is the district judge, and he believed that California law did not allow for a lawsuit against Target because they didn't have an AED. And we took that up on appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decided that they wanted to have input from the California Supreme Court and certified the question of whether or not Target would have a duty to have an AED on the premises under any circumstances. And the Supreme Court of California, after a hearing that I attended and argued our side of the case for, decided no, that there was no duty of Target to have an AED on premises in California. And they sent that over to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals adopted their opinion. The Ninth Circuit adopted the California Supreme Court's opinion as to the California legal aspects.
And these are known as generally progressive-leaning courts. So what do you think the odds are that the U.S. Supreme Court, which tends to be conservative and pro-business, that they will actually agree to at least hear this case, let alone decide in your favor?
I think the odds are long, but I think it's worth doing. I think that because 360,000 people a year die of sudden cardiac arrest in non-hospital settings, it's worth taking the chance that the Supreme Court might decide not to hear this case, and the chance that the Supreme Court, if it did hear the case, would rule in favor of saying that, yes, in fact, Target or any other stores that have big boxes that are similarly situated to Target, those stores would be negligent not to have at least one AED on their site in the case that anybody can have a sudden cardiac arrest. You can be a finely tuned athlete and have one. A lot of high school athletes do, and college athletes have them. Of course, older folks do.
But that's a good question. Are you advocating also for requiring these in schools and athletic facilities, or are they already
usually
required?
They have them. Usually they have them. The
so
states,
required,
yeah,
they?
The high the schools are required to have them, and that's good. That's a really good thing. And it's not just kids that are at risk. It's all of us.
If the Supreme Court does not take action or does not rule in your favor, do you believe the ultimate answer is legislation at the congressional level, or failing that, at the state and local levels to require these AEDs in facilities such as big box stores, as the city of San Diego has already done?
That's exactly right. That's where Monsta PAC comes in to advocate for federal candidates that support the proliferation of AEDs.
What about the power of consumers to raise their voices? We've certainly seen recently consumer campaigns being successful in, for example, helping to persuade Petco to pull, you know, pet treats from China off of store shelves that were poisoning and killing a lot of pets. Do you think that if consumers get organized and let their voices be heard, or maybe the power of their shopping dollars by going someplace like Costco that has AEDs instead of Target that doesn't, and letting Target know, or other retailers like Walmart?
We just heard about another sudden cardiac arrest that was a fatality in Pittsburgh in a Walmart store late this last year, a few months ago.
So what can consumers out there who shop at these stores do?
Well, I think I've heard about these petitions that people do online to attempt to get the attention of a corporation that they believe needs to take the consumer's interest to heart.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry for the pun, but in this case, I guess it's a
heartfelt issue, yes. Well, there you go. Is that something you've looked at starting? Are you considering launching one of those petitions, David?
I haven't, but I certainly encourage anybody who has the desire to do that to look into that, because I think that could be perhaps the most effective means to get these things proliferated.
Yeah, quickly and on a large scale, perhaps,
exactly.
Without waiting for each local or state legislature to take action.
Or waiting for the wheels of justice to turn.
There you go. Do you have any parting thoughts for us today on this very important issue, David?
Yes, I do. I hope that the United States Supreme Court will agree to hear this very important case, which could save many hundreds of thousands of lives per year with respect to those who suffer sudden cardiac arrest outside of a hospital setting.
Very good. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And listeners, if you tuned in late, we've been speaking with David Griffin Eisenstein, who is a San Diego County-based lawyer who is taking on Target and big box retail stores in a landmark case, trying to get the U.S. Supreme Court to hear a case that could require big box retailers to install automatic external defibrillators that science has shown will save 60% of lives if they can be used within the first few minutes when someone collapses with cardiac failure.
Absolutely.
If people want to get more information about the lawsuit itself, David, where can they go?
Well, one place they can go is to the monstapac.com, monstahpac.com, which, although it's a political action committee, one of our issues is supporting the proliferation of AEDs in big box stores and other places of public assembly. We have a section called news releases, and one of our news releases deals with the case that has been brought on behalf of Marianne Verdugo.
Okay, and if you want information about the effectiveness of the automated external defibrillators and the dangers of sudden cardiac arrest, you can also go to the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Foundation, which is a nonprofit, and their website is scaf.org.
Yes, and they have actually prepared and published articles on their website that deal with our case. And they were a very important part of the case because they filed an amicus brief in the California Supreme Court.
Very good. Thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show, David, on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to...
While the thought of eating the family dog or cat may sound repulsive to most Americans, in some cultures it is considered quite normal. One California group is trying to change that perception. Fia Pereira co-founded the U.S. branch of the animal advocacy group No to Dog Meat, based in Los Angeles. Pereira says an underground dog and cat meat trade exists in U.S. cities, including Los Angeles and San Bernardino. She says some cultures believe the animal's meat tastes better only after the animal has been frightened.
The level of torture in which these animals go through is one of the most horrific things I've ever seen. Being plunged into vats of boiling water, skinned alive, tortured in front of other animals.
Pereira says in some cases the dogs and cats are stolen pets. No to Dog Meat is working on raising awareness of the torture often found in the underground meat trade and to close pet consumption loopholes that exist in laws. The consumption of cat or dog meat is legal in 44 U.S. states, but specific details of the laws vary from state to state. In California, it is a misdemeanor to consume the carcass of an animal that was kept as a pet. Asking people to give up eating what is acceptable to them is not without controversy, and Pereira says while her group respects other cultures' traditions,
torturing a dog or a cat for human consumption is not tradition. It's just blatant torture, and there's no place in a civilized, evolved society.
There is an online petition to Governor Jerry Brown asking him to tell sister state Canton, China, to stop the cat and dog meat trade. Pereira says the effort needs to be global. 11 regions around the world that eat dog meat include Taiwan, Mexico, Vietnam, Switzerland, the Arctic, Antarctic, China, Indonesia, Korea, Philippines, and Polynesia. For Public News Service, I'm Monique Coppola.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Kirk Lee Ader, author and photographer of the nonfiction book Child of the Storm, which recounts the life and surfing career of San Diego surf star Chris O'Rourke. My guest's work has appeared in publications such as Sports Illustrated, Outside, Islands, and Surfer, along with many international magazines. Ader has also co-authored Big Island Days and the Great Hawaii Sports Journal. Child of the Storm is his third book. Welcome, Kirk. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back in San Diego here. I grew up here, and it's always great to come back.
Let's start with a little historical information about Chris O'Rourke. I know that he also grew up in San Diego County, and at age 16, he became the number one rated surfer from mainland United States. He had only one goal, as I understand it, to become a world champion. Without giving too much away about your book, what happened to Chris and his dream, and how did you become involved in it?
Chris's story is very dynamic yet complex at the same time. He's actually originally from the East Coast, where the O'Rourke family all grew up, but they came to San Diego in the mid to late 60s and for various reasons had to almost flee the East Coast. And Chris and his father had a bit of a rift going on. When they arrived in San Diego, Chris didn't really want anything to do with surfing. He didn't like it at all. But his older brother, Bart, started surfing, and eventually Chris became hooked by it too. And it really, he accelerated in surfing very, very quickly, learned how to surf at La Jolla Shores. Eventually, the family moved up towards Windansea, which, of course, a lot of people know can be a very localized surfing spot. Mm-hmm. Chris, with O'Rourke's, is a Irish background there, and Chris mm-hmm. had a kind of a fiery temper, and once he got out into the Windansea lineup and learned how to surf even better and better, he really released a lot of anger, I think, that he felt towards his father through his surfing, and he just fit right into the scene at Windansea, and before he knew it, his surfing just accelerated, and he became a very dynamic force and became very, very good at what he did.
Now, how did you become involved with him? How did you meet him and witness his life?
Sure. I actually first met him briefly when I was going to Scripps Elementary in La Jolla Shores in the sixth grade. The family had actually moved back to New York temporarily for a few months, but returned to La Jolla, and he was in my school for a few months. Then they moved back uptown, La Jolla, and then from there, he was in my grade at Mirlands Junior High in La Jolla, and then also in La Jolla High. And I started shooting surfing photographs in about the 10th grade at La Jolla High School. Mm-hmm. And at that time, well, Chris was the number one rated surfer from the U.S. mainland. So if I was going to get anywhere in my photography, he was the guy that I was going to shoot. I had the best guy right there. And I made it a point to try to shoot photos of him whenever possible. And that really kicked the whole thing off.
And what was it like seeing him surf that close and photographing it?
It was incredible. At the time, you know, in the mid-70s, surfing was kind of a misunderstood sport. The professionalism part was just getting off the ground. And surfing was searching for an identity. Was it an art form? Was it a sport? But there were a lot of people that were trying to elevate it to a higher level. And even Chris at a young age was one of those. He was a prodigy surfer in so many ways, just like 11-time world champion Kelly Slater is today. Mm-hmm. He was winning all the contests. He was beating the guys 10 years older than him. He elevated through the ranks of what was called the WSA, Western Surfing Association. And he got put in the 4A category when he was 14 years old. That's how good he was, because normally that division is reserved for surfers 18 years old or older. Mm-hmm. He just really elevated through the ranks very fast. And before you know it, he was right there at the top. When the WSA folded in 1976, Chris was the number one rated surfer in the 4A division. And then when the Pro Tour started that same year, he was all set to go on the Pro Tour, but unfortunately he was still in high school. So he kind of had to wait till the following year in 1977, which he did. But he was the first guy from California to really lead the charge and take it to the rest of the world. At that time, surfing was dominated by South Africans, Hawaiians, and Australians. So,
Do you remember what you thought when you first saw him surf?
I thought he was a dominant force, and he definitely stood out far above the rest of the surfers that I saw in the water through his maneuvers and everything. He was clearly the best guy out there.
And what a challenge to capture it on film.
And on film, it was great. Of course, back then, it was manual focus cameras, right, and shooting slide film and not like the technology we have today, which is, of course, great. So you kind of had to be conservative also, too, in how you shot your film, because every press of the button of the shutter cost you money. So, but with Chris, it was good because all the maneuvers he did were very, very strong.
Now, I know that Chris died before his time of cancer in 1981, and you're quoted as saying that his story is not about duration, but about brilliance.
That's correct.
What lessons do you believe are highlighted by Chris for anyone who reads about them?
I think the first really key lesson is that, and I'm a firm believer in this, if you have your health, you have everything. And anybody who's healthy, if you know, there's always going to be other troubles and good things and bad things in your life. But obviously cancer is a big factor for a lot of people today. Both my parents have had cancer. They're still alive today. They've been able to battle it. But what I learned from Chris is if you're healthy, you have a lot. And I'm reminded of that all the time in my own life. If I ever have a bad day, all I have to do is think about Chris, and it really kind of kicks me back into place. And realize, well, again, I'm healthy, I have good things going on, and I try to look at it that way. He had some family issues, too, and I think if you have a strong family, that's good. There's so many variables in this book to talk about and to go through. It really touches on a lot of different aspects of life, tragedy, turmoil, greatness, friendships, and ultimately inspiration, which he did. He inspired so many people by his fight for survival and to go through life, and he fought right up until the very end.
Now, do you see his surfing as a metaphor of that kind of, I don't know, strength and endurance, or do you see it as the beauty of the sport?
Most definitely, surfing kept him alive, in my opinion, longer than he should have survived. He got such a strength from going out in the ocean and surfing, and he also got really a lot of strength because he had a wife and a son. And those three factors right there really played a big role, I think, in extending his life. Surfing, though, he was drawn to the ocean like a magnet. Mm-hmm. And the ocean, of course, when you're surfing, there's so many variables and factors out there. It's not just the surfing on the wave itself, but the environment of being in the ocean. Right. And that really played a large part in his life. And
passion.
Passion, exactly.
Well, speaking of passion, you've had a long career as a photojournalist. Give us an inside look what it's like to photograph surfers and other amazing things to see and photograph. How do you get the right shot? And what's the process of capturing an exciting sport like that?
Well, I'm going to back up again here. Surfing in the mid-70s was kind of just searching for an identity. Now, today, there's a billion-dollar industry behind it, and it's really come a long way. For me to shoot surfing from the mid-70s up until today, I've seen a lot of that progress, and I've been able to go out and shoot events on the Pro Tour at different countries around the world and see guys come and go from different countries. And it's really been great to see how surfing has progressed as a sport, the maneuvers, the art form itself, and all the different identities that have evolved. And that's been the greatest thing. In the mid-70s, you had just surfing. Surfing spread then and created other sports like windsurfing, kite surfing, even other sports like land sports like snowboarding. So it's the evolution of the whole thing is what's been great to witness, and there's been certainly a lot of that. And surfing has gone from just being, you know, thought of in the old Gidget movies and the Beach Boy music and all that today, like I said, to this billion-dollar industry with huge companies like Quiksilver and Billabong, and it's really been a great thing.
But how do you get close enough to photograph the exciting moments?
Well, of course, you have your water cameras. You're swimming out there in the water, which is takes a lot of skill and expertise to get in, you know, on the wave and be on the wave, and you can shoot. Mostly you're swimming and trying to get in the right position, and that can be a difficult task depending on what surf spot you're shooting. But when you're not using the water camera, you use large telephoto lenses, just like when you're shooting football or something like that, and being on the beach and being able to capture the entire wave. And so it's either shooting with telephoto lenses or water cameras, but either way, it's a really neat and fun thing to do.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it is. Yeah. I have one more question for you, Kirk. Okay. What's next? What are you working on now?
Well, it's an extension of the Child of the Storm book. We're actually trying to get and very close to having the Child of the Storm book be picked up by a movie producer. And we're trying to get that done, and we're very close. But as everyone knows, I'm working with Hollywood and everything. It takes a while for these things to happen. But I'm hoping that in the next year that'll happen. I'm taking a little break from the writing part because The Child of the Storm took me 9 years to do. So it was pretty much a very extensive project, being that you're dealing with real people, real lives.
Sure.
So I decided to kind of take a break from that. And living in Hawaii, I just continue my photography over there.
Okay. Well, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me today again. It's been great.
For more information on Kirk Ader and his work, please visit his website at www.kirkaderphoto.com. And Ader is spelled A-E-D-E-R, kirkaderphoto.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Ancient treasures seized in seven U.S. cities, including San Diego, have been returned to the Italian government. Homeland Security offices, working with U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, conducted the investigations and returned 19 artifacts, including a 17th century cannon, 5th century Greek pottery, and ancient works of art. The artifacts were looted from their rightful Italian owners and smuggled into the United States during the last several years, according to Homeland Security. In July 2012, the department's San Diego office received information about four illegally excavated antiquities from clandestine sites in Pompeii owned by the Allen E. Paulson Trust. Homeland Security officers found and seized three frescoes dating back to the 1st century A.D. and one Askos pottery vessel dating back to the 4th century B.C. The trust forfeited the items to the U.S. government so that they could be returned to Italy. Additional seizures were made in New York, Boston, Buffalo, Baltimore, Miami, and San Francisco. Since 2007, Homeland Security has helped to return over 7,200 artifacts to 30 different countries. Members of the public who have information about suspected stolen cultural property are urged to call the toll-free tip line at 1-866-DHS-2-ICE. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement, Kevin McLeod, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.